Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.
This is The Athletic Football Show.
Welcome to The Athletic Football Show. I'm Robert Mays. Joining me, as she does every Thursday, it's Lindsay Jones. Lindsay, how are you?
I'm good, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing okay. There's a lot going on. We did not talk about the Titans situation on yesterday's podcast because I knew that I would be digging into it with you. We're going to get to the Patriots-Chiefs game, which is the game of the week. We're going to get to some Adam Gase sadness, which has come to dominate a lot of conversations over the last week or so. We're going to get some of our favorite matchups of the week, our biggest questions heading into week four. But before we do any of that, let's get to what has been undeniably the biggest NFL news of the week, something that you've been chasing and talking to people about essentially since it happened. So the Titans had several players test positive for COVID-19 earlier this week, along with some personnel. I just want you to kind of walk me through it. This is the Michael Scott, I'm 5 years old, my parents have given me a lemonade stand sort of thing. So if you're talking to me like I'm five and I don't understand this, can you just walk me through what has happened with the Titans in the past 72 hours or so?
Sure. So this is kind of the scenario that we all kind of feared would happen at some point this season, that there would be one person tested positive. There would be somebody who got infected, comes into an NFL facility, unknowingly transmits it to other people within the building. All of a sudden you have an outbreak. So right now, as of, you know, this is late Wednesday afternoon, early evening, there have been 10 positive cases, new confirmed positive cases within the Titans organization since last Saturday. So over the last 5 days, four players, six other staff members, neither the Titans nor the NFL have detailed who those other six people are. We know there's one coach, outside linebackers coach Shane Bowen. He's their de facto defensive coordinator. And this all kind of started really that, you know, if we walk back a couple days, was on Saturday morning, they got Shane Bowen's positive test back. So this was before the Titans left for Minnesota. So they sent Bowen home. The rest of the team, you know, they did some contact tracing. They decided that nobody else needed to be ruled out. They traveled to Minnesota. They played the game on Sunday against the Vikings, flew home to Tennessee. Everybody came back into the building for testing Monday morning. 5:30 a.m. on Tuesday, they get word of eight new positive tests. Cleared the building. Everybody goes home. Meanwhile, the Vikings have to shut down their facility. Everybody goes through additional testing. They're going through the contact tracing. And now Sunday's game, between the week four game between the Titans and the Steelers that was going to be in Nashville, has now been postponed. They're hoping that they're going to be able to play it either Monday or Tuesday. That's what the NFL has said so far. But a lot of that is going to depend on kind of what happens next. If there are more positive cases, if, you know, within the Titans organization, they had an additional positive case for a player that was returned on Thursday morning from Wednesday's testing. And given what we know, you know, about this virus and the incubation period, they're not out of the woods yet. There's, you know, it would be naive of any of us to assume that, you know, we're three or four days into this and that they have this outbreak contained. So as of now, you know, there's one game that is on hold. The Vikings-Texans game is still supposed to go on as scheduled, but I don't think the Vikings are completely out of the woods yet either. They need to, I think, make it a few more days without any positive tests before they can feel confident that they've made it through this. But yeah, so this is the first outbreak. It's the first major test of the NFL's protocols. And, you know, we're starting to get some answers about how is the NFL going to handle this in terms of when do you shut something down? And we have to now take a really deep look at what happened? What were the flaws in the system? Did the testing process fail? Did the protocols fail? Was this an individual team breakdown, an individual person breakdown? Because look, it's we're,
what are
we're
the
not
answers
even
to those questions? Because that's my first response is where is the crack in the system here? Is there any sort of idea? Do people have any guesses? Where does that conversation start?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we can look into here because there's testing, and is there a flaw in the testing protocols? And then was there something else in terms of mask wearing, social distancing? And Troy Vincent, he's the NFL's executive vice president of football operations. He's been the guy who's been sending the very sternly worded memos. You know, he sent one a couple weeks ago warning coaches that they were going to get fined if they didn't wear their masks. He sent a memo to all of the clubs on Wednesday morning that basically said, you know, you guys have been slacking on protocols, and saying that they have noticed some kind of lapses in distancing, mask wearing, you know, all of the things that are very explicitly laid out in a 71-page memo that all of the teams got on September 5th.
And that he, Mike Vrabel was very clear that he has read. He has seen the memo.
He said he read them verbatim, which
is there,
sure.
Is there any other way to read something?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that they're following them like to the T. But that's all going to be part of this. You know, the NFL is going to be investigating and trying to figure out exactly what happened. And, you know, I don't know if it does a ton of good to, you know, finger point a ton of like, well, this guy was the, you know, patient zero or whatever here. But it's going to be very instructive for the rest of the league to find out where were the lapses, or this is what can happen if just with one positive test, when one person comes in. And I don't want to speculate about exactly how it was contracted, because look, there's millions of Americans who have gotten this disease and in many number of ways. But the NFL and the NFLPA have laid out very clearly a list of prohibited behaviors, things like house parties and going to bars and going to concerts. And, you know, they can get fined.
Where are their concerts happening? Where can you go to a concert? I miss concerts.
Well, Robert, you and I both live in major metropolitan cities that have some pretty significant restrictions still in place. I think
yeah, there's those Smash Mouth concerts that were happening a couple months ago. I guess they are happening, just not in my kind of sphere of the world.
Yeah, I think you can go to Red Rocks has started having these like 150 people in Red Rocks type of concerts.
God, that'd be great. Red Rocks alone, it's the exact way I'd want to be at a concert.
Yeah, it's kind of an ideal scenario. But, you know, so they have laid out all these things that are prohibited. And if any of the members of the Titans or any other team, like the Oakland Raiders or the Las Vegas Raiders, excuse me, I need to put money in the fine jar for that. if they have violated these behaviors that are very clearly written out. And one of the kind of the catch-all in that is that players and all team employees are required to abide by state and local regulations. So, you know, I mentioned the Raiders here. They're now under investigation because a number of players, including Derek Carr, went to a charity gala for Darren Waller's charity and were photographed mingling with fans, not wearing masks. And that gathering had reportedly more than 100 people, which violates the Nevada state rules. So they're under investigation. The Raiders have already been punished. They had a locker room violation with an unauthorized person in their locker room a couple weeks ago. That was $250,000. So the NFL is serious about making sure that these protocols are adhered to. So I expect they're going to be much more vigilant about not just what's happening on Sundays in terms of mask wearing and distancing on the sidelines and the travel protocols and all that stuff, but what is happening in the buildings Monday through, you know, Saturday, really. Because what this Titans outbreak shows us is that just daily testing is not enough. I think there had very much become this idea around the NFL of, oh, we all tested negative, so we're fine. We can just live our lives like normal. But that's not the way this virus works. You just because you test positive one day doesn't mean you weren't exposed the day before and it's still, you know, incubating, hasn't shown up yet, and that you can't and that you won't test positive the next day and having our, you know, and will have already spread it to people. So that's why they're saying keep wearing your masks, wash your hands, don't congregate in groups. So it's, you know, it's not sexy stuff to talk about, but it does have the potential to have very real ramifications, you know, on this season. Look, the Titans Steelers, that should be the game of the week, right? Yeah. I mean, outside of this Patriots Chiefs game,
now
that was
going to
be the game
happen.
We were going to talk about. But now we don't even know if it's happening because of COVID, and it's going to affect other teams, other players, you know, the calendar down the line. So just a lot of really big questions, and, you know, hopefully they'll have this contained soon, but I think it would be naive or any of us to assume that, you know, just in a couple days, everything will be back to normal.
So my just the way my first response to this is I think about it and hear everything that you're saying is that one, this could be way worse than it is right now, because if he was tested positive on Saturday and had been around players and everything else, and some of these guys that, you know, had it, that there's no way to know if there aren't 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 more guys that do. And are there guys in the Vikings that have it? So they're not out of the woods yet. And hopefully this is as bad as it gets, but it certainly doesn't have to be. Why isn't there testing on Sunday? What is the thought process behind not having day of game testing? Because it seems like they're testing every other day. Wouldn't that just be one more protocol you could put in place to kind of catch some of this stuff?
Yeah, so that is it's a really good question. And I think that's one of the things that they have to look at right now. And that's something that maybe will change, or they have to look at and see if it's going to change. So, you know, the final game day, game week testing cadence, they kind of finalized that right heading into week one, just a couple of days actually before the start of the regular season. And if we remember back to training camp, the big issue with testing wasn't lots of guys testing, you know, having new confirmed cases. It was these false positives. It was Matthew Stafford having a false positive, getting put on the COVID-19 list, his family facing all sorts of public backlash, you know, in early. It was right after the start of training camp. And then there was the day that there were the 77 false positive cases based on a lab error in at the BioReference lab in New Jersey that affected a whole bunch of teams. So there was this immediate backlash from around the league, from the teams, especially, that said, well, what's going to happen with these false positives? I don't want, you know, what if Patrick Mahomes has a false positive on a Sunday morning and they force him to miss the game and he wasn't actually, you know, infected? So there is not, the NFL has not explicitly said why there is no Sunday testing, but the working theory is that the fear of the false positives is a big part of that. The other part is that just strictly based on timing and the tests that the NFL uses as their primary tests are these, they're called PCR tests. They're the ones that take about 24 hours to get back, sometimes less depending on where the lab is located.
Tested multiple times. I'm aware of the vacillations in response time, even if they say it's quick.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if I was going to go get one just at a drive-up clinic, I wouldn't get mine back in 12 to 24 hours, probably, unless I paid a lot more money. But, you know, so these are the ones that are more sensitive, more accurate, but also they, you know, since they are so sensitive, they can pick up kind of the old viral matter. But then the rapid tests, the ones where you can get the results, you know, within a couple hours, if not less time than a couple hours, they're not as sensitive. They're more prone to being inaccurate and having a false positive. So right now they're using those tests. The rapid test is confirmatory test. So if somebody tests positive, they'll get that secondary test. And if that one also comes back as positive, then it's a confirmed positive case. So, you know, so this was the risk reward, right? Is that or the gamble that the league made and the NFLPA made, is that by not testing on Sunday morning, you shouldn't be ruling anybody out because of a false positive. But in this case, maybe if they had been testing on Sunday morning, maybe they could have caught a couple of these Titans players or a couple of Titans coaches who then, you know, had positive results from their Monday test, would have kept them out, could have isolated them, wouldn't have exposed those players to the Vikings. Because that's the really big
thing. Absolutely. That's how it gets out of control.
Yeah, is that when another team is exposed, and that, you know, and it's not just these two teams too. Once you get into a game day environment, there's officials, there's the cameramen, there's, you know, the locker room attendants. I mean, there are other people, you know, some stadiums have fans in the stands, and yes, the players don't have direct contact with the fans, but there's just a lot of really big kind of public health questions and things going on there.
And even beyond the public health questions, you get to the scheduling question. So if it goes from one team to two teams, now you're affecting four teams the following Sunday. So if we're talking about the Titans-Steelers game, let's say it's not postponed. Well, let's say it's postponed for a while. It can't happen on Monday or Tuesday. That's the decision they ultimately make. What mechanisms are in place with the way the schedule has laid out, or with the league's thinking, that kind of would allow them to get around that issue, play all 16 games, and make sure that we kind of keep this thing on the tracks?
Yeah, I mean, there's no simple solution. You know, the NFL didn't build in a lot of contingency plans into the schedule back when they created it in April, in terms of, you know, overlapping bye weeks and, you know, kind of a collapsible schedule where if you had to pull one whole week of games out or one team, you could just easily move things around. So, you know, there are dominoes that could fall. So if it's strictly the Titans Steelers game that would need to get rescheduled, there's some ways you could move it. They do not have the same bye week, but they have common opponents that have the same bye week. So you could shuffle other teams' bye weeks to reschedule, you know, that game later into the season. It's around week 7 or 8. It's moving. I think the Ravens would have to move a game. There's a lot of other dominoes that would have to fall. So all of a sudden you're not just affecting the two teams and then the four teams, you're affecting, you know, a lot, you know, the dominoes continue to fall. The other potential option that they have left on the table is that it would be that that first week in January, that would normally be the wild card playoff week, that if there are a number of games that have had to be postponed, you can move them into that first week in January. The playoffs start a week later. There is that bye week between the championship game weekend and the Super Bowl that you could, in theory, pull out. Nobody's going to be playing the Pro Bowl. Right. So, you know, in theory, you just have 1 week before the Super Bowl, or they do have flexibility in terms of pushing the Super Bowl back later into February if they needed to.
There's no reason not to. I mean, it's just the NFL's stubbornness taking over. It's like, no, we're going to play it because that's what it's scheduled for. I don't think they're going to play the Pro Bowl this year, I would assume.
I think they have actually already canceled it. I
was going to say, would you put it past the league, though, to be like, you know what? Maybe we could try to do this for like the pennies in revenue that the Pro Bowl would create. They're just not willing to let that go. It wouldn't shock me at all if they were like, you know what? Maybe we can do that. A game that no one cares about in the world.
No, it wouldn't surprise me at all. It's all about the money. I mean, they're letting, you know, fans in right now when I don't really know why, because they're able to make a few bucks off of it. So, but yeah, so those are, I mean, there's not a ton of great options. You know, there's no options to play 17 doubleheaders like the St. Louis Cardinals had to do in baseball after they had to miss a bunch of games. Football just doesn't have those sort of options. It's, you know, it's not like college football where you get a game canceled, all of a sudden you pick up another opponent. You know, you kind of get, it's like a pickup game. That just,
yeah, there's
that's
no
not
Southern Alabama
here
waiting around to play the Titans this week if they have to reschedule.
Yeah,
a game.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the Steelers can't just make up a game on their schedule by picking up, you know, although, you know, I'd love to see them play Alabama or something. That would be fun. But, but yeah, so the NFL has this outside advisory committee. They're meeting now. It's this group of, you know, ex players, ex GMs, ex coaches who are working with Roger Goodell, Troy Vincent. They're the medical advisors, the NFLPA's advisors, to figure these things out. When do you have to cancel? If you have to cancel, where do you move it? All of those sorts of things. It's very complicated and
so fun. Really glad it's all happening. Just a great time all around.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, Lindsay, a week after a slate that it was difficult to pick a couple games to focus on because there were so many good ones, we do not have that problem this week. It's almost fitting that Jets Broncos is kicking off Thursday Night Football because it is not a good collection of games, especially if Titans Steelers doesn't happen. But one that is the exception is definitely the Chiefs and the Patriots. I mean, Bill Belichick said this week, it almost feels like a division game this week because of how often these two teams play. So before we dig into the specifics of the matchup between these two teams, I want to start with one big picture question. Right now, if you had to pick between Bill Belichick and Andy Reid to win one game, who would you pick?
So who's my quarterback?
All right, so let's set some parameters here. You have league average players at every position, including quarterback. So let's say that Kirk Cousins is your quarterback, and then you have the Kirk Cousins of every other position at those spots. So it's like, I don't know, Charles Leno is your left tackle. Sammy Watkins is one of your receivers. Just guys that are guys. And that's what you have to work with. You have 1 week to get ready for it. I know both of them are incredible with a bye, so that might not matter. But you have your normal get in on a Monday, play on a Sunday preparation schedule. Which direction are you going?
Yeah. Okay. This
and
pains me to say
roster. Let's be clear.
It's the same roster.
Same roster. They're playing each other.
I'm going to go with Belichick. And it pains me to say this a little bit because I think anybody who's listened to this podcast for very long knows how I feel about Andy Reid and the Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes especially. But the thing that Bill Belichick has done better than any other coach in NFL history is that he figures out how to play to his players' strengths. And I trust that given a random roster of guys, even Kirk Cousins guys, that I would take Bill Belichick for one game. Because the knocks on Andy Reid, right, are not his like schematic stuff. It would be game management. And if I have one game, I guess I'm gonna go Bill Belichick. Also, here's my other question. Who's his staff? Do they have their current staff?
So you get your staffs. So you get McDaniels if you pick this.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm even more solidly in the Belichick camp.
So I tend to agree with you, and for the reasons that you said. I think that we've seen Bill Belichick succeed with more types of teams and just over a longer period of time. The job he's done so far with Cam Newton and this revamped group is pretty much all the evidence I need. But with Andy Reid, I don't think Andy Reid is a lesser coach than Bill Belichick right now. I think that Patrick Mahomes is his muse and has pushed him to just an entirely different level. It's almost like when you have a band and the band is great together, but when they splinter off, one guy's better as a solo artist than the other person was. That's like Andy Reid. Andy Reid in the band with Patrick Mahomes is just as good as Bill Belichick has ever done. But if you took Patrick Mahomes away from him, I'm just not sure it would be the same results. So that's where I'm landing on this.
And I would say, I mean, because we've kind of seen what Andy Reid is with a mid-range quarterback, and it's a good coach.
It's
and those
very
are good teams.
Good. Those, yes,
those Alex Smith, the Donovan McNabb teams. I mean, those were good teams, and he's still one of the best coaches of all time. But I mean, that's, you know, we talk about matchups a lot, right, on the show, and the matchups of the week. This is the best matchup of the week is Belichick versus Reid, and there's so much to get into, and I just love thinking about what these two guys are thinking right now when they're inside their buildings, game planning for each other, going back through the previous years that they've played. You know, I'm sure Belichick watched that Monday night game and what the Chiefs did to the Ravens defense and took a lot of notes and probably learned a lot of things and probably was yelling at his TV about what the Ravens were doing. I'm really, really excited for this coaching matchup. I guess I wasn't expecting that we were both going to be on Team Belichick here.
I just feel like Belichick is, it doesn't matter what you give him. You could give him essentially the roster that Kyle Shanahan has worked with for the last 2 weeks, which is like 10 random dudes off the street, and he would be competitive in a game. I think that Andy Reid has benefited from Patrick Mahomes just lifting the lid. Reid is so creative, and I think that the ways he's taken this offense have been spurred on by Patrick Mahomes being an unlimited player. So Andy Reid's creativity no longer has any restraints on it, and you've seen him go to heights that he's just never been able to go to before. That's the cool part of this. I just don't know if he could do that with a quarterback that actually has limitations. So that's the difference, is that Belichick is just better with average players, where Mahomes is, or Reid has been kind of pushed on by the greatness that Mahomes provides to him. So talking about that matchup and what they're thinking right now, let's dig into that, because I feel like the Andy Reid, Bill Belichick, Patriots defense versus Patrick Mahomes matchup is definitely the most intriguing part of this entire game. So to try to find some answers, because I feel like everyone's trying to figure this out this week, what the Patriots are going to do, I went back and I watched that Week 14 game from last season to see what I could glean from it. And the answer was not very much. So it was pretty, from what I saw, it was a pretty even mix of man and zone with not that many tendencies. So it's not as if on later downs they were playing a bunch of man, on early downs they were playing a bunch of zone. I think on third and about mediums or so, you saw some press man coverage, but they also played some zone on third down. So not surprisingly, Bill Belichick not throwing out any overt tendencies that you can get a handle on. This is how they did it. Stephon Gilmore was covering Sammy Watkins. Jonathan Jones was covering Tyreek Hill, which makes sense because Jonathan Jones runs a 4-3. So if you're thinking about your personnel, that would make sense. The Patriots blitzed on 5 of Mahomes' dropbacks. 5. Compare that to what happened on Monday night when the Ravens blitzed on 23 of his 47 dropbacks. What do you think his passer rating was on blitzes on Monday night?
I mean, what's perfect?
I mean, it was close just to perfect. South of perfect, 151.5. He averaged 10.9 yards per attempt. He was 19 of 23 for 250 yards and three touchdowns against the blitz. And you look at what the Patriots' tendencies were as a team last year, they blitzed on 37% of dropbacks. It was the sixth highest rate in the league in 2019, and they only blitzed Mahomes five times. So where I land is somewhere close to what the Chargers have done to him and what other teams have done to him to give him trouble in the past. The Niners, for example, in the Super Bowl. You rush four, you drop seven. That's how you do things. Easier said than done, because he's pretty good against that too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was banging my head against my desk on Monday night, because the thing that Belichick defensively does best, right, is he knows exactly how an opponent can kill you. And he knows how Patrick Mahomes can kill you, and that's if you over blitz. And I just didn't understand why the Ravens didn't have a better answer for that, and why they just kept doing the same thing over and over and over again. So
I think it's a great philosophical question, though, because what do you want to do? Do you want to do the things you know you're good at,
yeah,
and play your game and lose? Or do you want to do things outside of your comfort zone that you don't think you do as well and lose? I would rather go down swinging to a certain degree if that's the style of defense we feel most comfortable playing. I understand it. Look, it seems counterintuitive, and it looks frustrating when he keeps hitting big play after big play. And maybe they should adjust a little bit more than they did. But I can understand saying, this is what we do. This is what we feel best about. We're going to go down as the team we are.
So let's just assume then that Belichick and this Patriots defense isn't going to be blitzing. Maybe it is five times. Maybe it's a max of seven times. Maybe it's less times than that. What's the matchup that you think will be the best then for the Chiefs to exploit? If that, you know, if they are doing that style of let's just rush four, let's drop seven, who's the guy that you think they can get the most out of? Is it, you know, is it Travis Kelce? Is it Tyreek Hill in that one-on-one matchup? Or is it Clyde Edwards-Helaire, who they didn't have much of a running game in early December when they played last year? Is that a place where maybe the Chiefs could have an edge this week?
I'd be curious to see what it looks like. Watching that game last year, it seems like the Patriots, this might be a coaching point overall, I'd have to go back and watch more games, their corners get incredible depth in cover two. And I think that that might be a response to how deep the safeties have to get. When you talk about teams stretching zones or stretching defenses with speed, it's so funny watching the All-22, seeing it practically with the Chiefs. You just see guys bailing out because of Tyreek Hill and Mecole Hardman. It's amazing to watch in real time. So I think that by having that sort of depth, you can kind of exploit some things underneath. They're almost daring you to do that. So are they going to go to Clyde Edwards-Helaire in the flat a little bit more, take what's there, not try to push the ball down the field when there just aren't openings to do it? Kelsey's a really, really good receiver against zone defenses, though. He's so savvy. So I feel like he's still going to be the focal point of what they try to do. But I think the answer is it's going to be difficult in the same way that it has been for them in the past. For the most part, when teams play that sort of defense against him, and when you have a strong pass rush with a front four, they can contain Mahomes in a way that we just don't often see him contained. He normally finds a way at the end, but I do think it's a way to slow him down. The question is, do the Patriots have that sort of pass rush? You know, Chase Vinovich has been playing better than he did last year. He's definitely taken a step forward, but I don't think this group is like the Chargers with Joey Bosa or like the Niners were in the Super Bowl. They don't have that sort of talent up front to really make Mahomes uncomfortable without having to bring extra pressure.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. And that's where this is going to come down to those like individual matchups and figuring out exactly the best ways to exploit it. I thought it was interesting to watch what they did, the Patriots defense did against Darren Waller last week.
It's a great example.
Not on Travis Kelce's level, but he's kind of in that next tier of up and coming, really good pass catching tight ends. And
has, you know, the same spot in the pecking order of receiver on his team. He's the best and most important receiver on his team, the same way that Kelce is.
Yeah. And I just, you know, they kind of did some combinations of, you know, safeties with some linebacker help, or, you know, last year a lot, they did, they would use kind of a corner Joan Williams on a tight end and then bring, you know, some linebacker safety help. So, you know, I don't think there's one guy on that Patriots secondary that's going to be able to cover Travis Kelce one-on-one. So, you know, it's just going to be a matter of, is it Jason McCourty? Is it Devin McCourty? Is, you know, do they get corner help? I just think that this Chiefs defense, or this Chiefs offense, excuse me, is just so diverse, so scary, that I don't know. I just don't really see a way, a clear way that you stop them.
There is no clear way. There's no good answer. And I think that the Patriots are going to do what they've done over the first few games of this season. They've had six guys in their defensive backfield play at least 115 snaps. They've had one linebacker play more than 100. That's been Juwan Bentley. They pretty much have put six defensive backs on the field on almost every single play, a mixture of defensive backs. You know, Jawan Williams, like you said, last week he had about nine snaps, but several of them were in man coverage on Waller. Then Jason McCourty was covering him in the red zone. You have Devin McCourty down there a little bit. They're really mixing it up. They have so many bodies back there, whether it's Adrian Phillips is playing a bunch of snaps for them. Terrence Brooks is playing a little bit for them. They clearly are leaning into this defensive back heavy look. So if they do that, if they're coming out in nickel and dime every single play, do the Chiefs say, all right, let's try to run the ball a little bit? I think if they do that, and if they overreact to just the personnel on the field for the Patriots, that's a win for New England. If you can convince them to run the ball more than they would in another situation, I think that's the first thing. You almost Jedi mind trick them with the way that you're lining up to get them to play a way you want them to play. All right. That's enough on that side of the ball in that matchup. Is there anything just within this game that might be a little bit overlooked or something we're not talking about as much that you feel like you'll be paying attention to?
Yeah, well, we haven't talked about Cam Newton yet and what this Patriots offense looks like. So, you know, kind of an important guy. And I've just been very curious to watch the kind of just this evolution. And look, it's only been 3 weeks, but, you know, I mean, how many minutes and hours did we spend over, you know, I guess since he signed around July 4th of what will the Patriots offense look like with Cam Newton? And what we've seen is that it's through 3 weeks, it's looked vastly different in each of the Patriots' first three games. And that is really fun and also should be really terrifying if you are Steve Spagnuolo and, you know, any other defensive coordinators that the Patriots are going to play, because, you know, we've seen a game plan that was very read option heavy, very Cam Newton running heavy. We've seen an offensive game plan where they just let Cam throw. And yes, they lost that game against the Seahawks, but they didn't lose it strictly because of that, you know, of their offense. You know, I think their defense had some big roles in that too. And, you know, we've seen that, hey, look, Cam Newton's a really, really good passer. And it was almost funny to listen to like the broadcast act like it was the first time that they realized that Cam Newton could throw the ball, because he's damn good at it. And so we've seen a game plan where he threw the ball a lot. And then last week against the Raiders, you know, they cut down on their read option plays even more. And they just had this really kind of classic, straightforward rushing attack where, you know, it was Sony Michel had his best game of the season, and they were just really kind of running a more of a traditional style. So what do you think is the best way offensively to attack this Chiefs defense, given what we saw at Kansas City, the way that they played against Baltimore in their run game on Monday night? And I'm also just wondering what might come next. What's the next layer that Josh McDaniels is dreaming up that Cam Newton hasn't tried yet?
I'll be curious to see if New England just says, we're going to try to push you around, especially if Chris Jones doesn't end up playing. He has a groin injury, so he's questionable right now. The interior of the Patriots offensive line is a question. You know, Joe Thuney played center for them last week after David Andrews went on IR with a broken thumb, which, can we talk about that for a second? These guys just playing different positions like it's no big deal and thriving. We're not talking about this enough. Zach Martin last week against the Seahawks just casually was like, I'm going to play right tackle now and be really good at it. That seems like it's easy. That's absolutely ridiculous. For Joe Thuney, with almost no notice, people on the outside of the building didn't know, just to slide over to center as a guard worthy of the franchise tag and to play extremely well, that's incredibly hard. It's really, really difficult to do, and he seemed to have no issue. So how that interior, I guess, front seven versus the offensive line, when you could throw the linebackers in there too. I thought that the Chiefs linebackers played a much better game on Monday than I expected them to.
Yeah,
Damian Wilson had a really nice game. Thought that their run defense in general was really solid. Great rush discipline from the defensive line. You saw them just understanding that they had to keep Lamar contained. So I'll be curious to see how that group matches up. New England really wants to run the ball. That's the style that they're playing this year. They're leaning on it really heavy. They're playing faster than they did in week one. They played at the slowest pace in the league after week one. I thought that maybe that's something they would stick with just to try to muddy up these games. I wouldn't be surprised at all if we went back to that this week, where they just said, we're going to let the play clock tick down every single time, and we're going to try to win this game 21-17 and keep Mahomes off the field as much as we can.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. And look, Belichick and Josh McDaniels are probably the smartest duo, coaching duo in the league. And I don't think they'll be dumb enough to keep giving Patrick Mahomes chances. They're not going to punt to him in overtime, is what I'm saying.
I think that I understand teams that want to say, all right, we're going to try to score with you. Like last week when Mike McCarthy came out and said, all right, we're going to try to go punch for punch with the Seahawks offense. When your defense is actively bad and your passing game is very good, I have no problem with that. I think that you should try to be the team that you are and play to your strengths. New England right now, their strengths are playing defense and running the ball. So you can try to shorten the game. That is the best version of who you want to be. Again, similar to what the 49ers tried to do last year. There's a way to shorten the game and still be aggressive. You go for it on fourth and one, things like that. I think you have to split the difference. You have to try to score a touchdown in every possession. You don't kick field goals, go for it on fourth down, but still try to limit the amount of total possessions that happen in the game.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, all of this basically comes down to, I'm actually really excited about this game, and I'm more excited about this game than if Brady were still the Patriots quarterback. I just think it's such a different dynamic having Cam Newton as their quarterback now, and the matchups are just way more interesting. So this is by far away the game of the week, with the asterisk about Steelers-Titans, you know, 2-3-0 teams.
I'd still give it to Patriots-Chiefs even if Steelers-Titans was going to happen. So I think we're okay.
Yeah, I think so too. And I made the mistake of picking against the Chiefs last week, and I'm not going to do it again. So if I had to be on record, I would pick the Chiefs to come out of this game.
I would as well. I think it's hard to pick against them right now. All right, let's get to our individual matchup of the week that we're most looking forward to, that we think is the most interesting. Why don't we start with you? What are you looking for? Maybe if the game isn't as high profile, but just a back and forth that you're going to keep an eye on.
All right. Well, I do think the game is interesting. It's not as high profile, but we got Browns Cowboys this week. And I'm specifically looking forward to watching the matchup of the Browns running backs, Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt, against the Cowboys defense, their Cowboys linebackers, who have been fine. But I think, you know, this is the best path forward for the Browns to win this game is to slow it down, to let Hunt and Chubb do the bulk of the work. They've been really fun to watch together. It's just such an interesting, diverse, dynamic running back duo that we don't really see anywhere else in the league right now. And, you know, they're the only duo that's both over 200 yards through 3 weeks. You know, they have very different skill sets. You know, Kareem Hunt is getting a lot of the receiving targets as well. You know, Nick Chubb is doing a lot of his work kind of in chunk plays in the middle of the field, not so much on the goal line, which fantasy players will notice. But I really like this matchup, and I really like this duo. And I just want to see more of that. And I think, you know, it's in Kevin Stefanski's like DNA to run the ball a lot. I mean, that's just really like who he was with the Vikings. So I want to see them do more of that. I want to see, you know, how much play action they can do. I want to see how many screens they can do. So that's one of the matchups, I guess, that I'm just most interested. What do you think? I know that you and I aren't maybe totally aligned on Nick Chubb right now.
Oh, no. I think that, so you look at the production, and a lot of the numbers with Nick Chubb fall in line with what he's been during his career, which is a fantastic running back. Coming into this season, I probably would have said that I thought Nick Chubb was the best pure runner in the NFL. You know, he's up near the top of the league in yards after contact per attempt pretty much every single year, which is a sticky stat. Breaking tackles is something that translates from season to season. And he's right up there again. He's second in the league in yards after contact per attempt. It's 4.25. And he's averaging over 5 yards per carry, and he's ninth in rushing DVOA right now. The Browns as a team are 10th. But the weird part is, and the crazy part is, I don't think he's playing particularly well. The offensive line for the Browns, in my opinion, is probably the most improved positional unit in the entire league. So you go and you get Jack Conklin, who hasn't even played that much, which speaks to the coaching that they've had. Jedrick Wills comes in as your first-round pick. He's been good right away. I think Wyatt Teller, their right guard, we talked about him a little bit with Joe Thomas a couple weeks ago. He's been one of the best players in football through 3 weeks, full stop. That line is mauling people in the run game. And I don't know how well Chubb is seeing things right now. Because if you, when I was going into this season, I expected this to be an outside zone team with play action stuff. Their run game has been much more diverse than that. Ton of pulling guys, a lot of power plays, really different looks in the run game, which has been really good for the line. It's given them angles, allowed them to succeed. But I don't know how well Nick Chubb is seeing that stuff. You know, when we think about continuity and how much practice time matters, I don't think we talk about running backs that often because it's just such a plug-and-play position in people's minds. But when the things in front of you are a lot different than they've looked in the past, there can be an acclimation period. So I think he's seeing things a little bit slowly, but he's so good and so powerful and so good at breaking tackles that the production hasn't fallen off at all. And if your team's playing the Browns, that's a pretty terrifying proposition, right? The guy's averaging 5 yards per carry and he's not even playing very well. If he gets into a groove and he starts seeing things a little bit better, I think the sky is the absolute limit for this running game.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Kareem Hunt is really freaking good too.
Yeah, like, he's really good.
He's starting to really get back into kind of his groove and remembering of why this guy led the NFL in rushing a couple years ago. And, you know, I hope for his sake that he keeps his personal life kind of on the direction that it's going, because, you know, he really has this chance now to kind of completely resurrect his career in one of the most interesting dynamic offenses. And I just love that it's also taking all this attention away from Baker Mayfield and this pressure off of Baker and Odell and the rest of this passing game. Because I'm not sure if that passing game right now is ready to get into a shootout with Dak Prescott. Dak Prescott, 500 yards a game, 4 touchdowns a game, Dak Prescott right now. So if they're going to win, like I said, if they're going to win, Chubb and Hunt need to have a really, really big game. And I think they can do it against that Dallas front. You know, their pass rush has been decent. Alden Smith is leading the league with 4 sacks right now, but I'm not specifically sold on the interior of their defensive line or their linebacking core when they're still without Leighton Vander Esch.
Absolutely. And I think that Joe Thomas has been okay. Jalen Smith has actually been probably the lesser of their two linebackers this season. In coverage, he's been all over the place. And I think that that contract is looking worse and worse the more he tends to play, because he has.
Are you saying the Cowboys give some bad contracts?
I think they might have. I think they might have valued the wrong position and paid the wrong guys rather than extending their very good quarterback. So I totally agree with you. I think that watching what the Browns have done over the first 3 weeks, I'm really impressed with the vision and the plan that Kevin Stefanski has had and the willingness he's had to kind of lean on his assistant coaches. Because he's a first-year head coach. He's 37 years old. He's somebody that's been in the league for a long time and understands how important it is to have a really good staff. And Bill Callahan has built that run game, and the design of that run game has been impeccable. And I think sticking with it, Kevin Stefanski's a smart guy. He understands the numbers. Yeah, I think he's more into analytics than probably most head coaches in the NFL, most coaches in the NFL, period, are. It's probably one of the reasons he has that job in Cleveland. And them running as much as they are kind of flies in the face of what numbers would tell you right now. But I do think that the way they've built this offense and insulating Baker Mayfield in the way they have is the smartest way to do it. This is the best plan and the best overall approach for them to succeed. And I think their willingness to adapt that and really embrace it has been one of the reasons that they've been on the right track so far this year. All right, let's get to mine. And I want to be clear about this before we start. There was a lot of Nick Foles talk on yesterday's podcast. My matchup is the Bears offense against the Colts defense. And it's not so I can talk about Foles more. I actually want to talk about the Colts defense. So through 3 weeks, the Indianapolis Colts are number one in defensive DVOA. So that's, I understand that might be misleading, that they've played some really bad offenses. They played the Vikings when you had Kirk Cousins doing Kirk Cousins things. They played against the Jets, who we will absolutely get to. And they played against Gardner Minshew, who actually kind of tore them up a little bit over the second half of that game. So if you look at some of these numbers, the Colts are getting pressure on 35.5% of their dropbacks. That is the second highest rate in the NFL. They're blitzing at the second lowest rate in the NFL. That's not surprising. The Colts under Matt Eberflus, who I think is a very good defensive coordinator, play a ton of zone. They don't blitz a lot. They do the things they do, and they play fast because of it. It's a simple defense, and guys have really come to understand it. DeForest Buckner has been everything they wanted him to be after they traded a first-round pick for him. He has 2 sacks. He's got 10 pressures. He's been a monster. Darius Leonard has been really good. And shockingly, Xavier Rhodes has been really good. I think dropping him back into his zone defense, not asking him to cover people one-on-one and having him just be a cog in what they're doing, it's worked for them. So are they going to be able to keep this up against better teams? I'm not saying the Bears are a better team, but I do think that they're better than the Jets. So I'm really excited, as somebody who watches the Bears closely every week, to get an up-close and personal look at exactly what this Colts defense is doing, because through the first month of the year, they've been as good as anybody in football.
Well, and what's been interesting, or what's been really interesting to me about watching this Colts defense, there's a couple things that jump out. One, it's that, you know, the upgraded talent, strictly the DeForest Buckner, huge addition. I have watched that play where he like literally killed a Vikings guard. They like made a movie trailer out of it.
Poor Drew Samia, who has never played much in the NFL, just getting thrown to the wolves in DeForest Buckner.
My God. But so there's some obvious talent upgrades there. And that is what's going to carry you week to week to week. And it's getting guys
especially
in the right position.
Especially when you have a simple defense. When you play a fairly simple defense, talent lifts you. It honestly reminds me of a lot of those Lovie Smith, Tampa 2-esque teams where it's like, we need one dominant three technique, a linebacker that can kick your ass, and solid secondary players that know the positions they're supposed to be in. That's exactly what they look like right now.
And that's what they have there. And, you know, and they've already sustained some injuries. You know, they lost Malik Hooker. Rock Ya-Sin had a weird, you know, he was like taken from the stadium in an ambulance a couple weeks ago, but sounds like he's going to be able to return fairly soon. So they've been dealing with some losses, you know, some injuries on the defensive side. The other thing, though, is that they're just scoring and producing takeaways at a ridiculous level. They've had they've scored on pick sixes in multiple weeks. They've had multiple pick sixes in multiple games. They've had safeties in back-to-back games. And takeaways are random, right? I mean, that's not something that you should be able to depend on week after week. But there is something that when it does happen in back-to-back games, there's just something about kind of creating your own luck and just feeling like, we're going to score and our defense is going to score and we're going to get those takeaways. And you start getting that feeling that like maybe there's really actually something special, and it's not just a good defense, but there's something actually really special there. And, you know, it would be naive. We cannot expect that the Colts defense is going to continue to score. They scored 16 points last week. Well, you know, two touchdowns and a safety. That's not going to happen every week. I can't imagine that will happen against the Bears this week, especially since Mitch Trubisky is not playing quarterback. But, you know, they're clearly feeling it. And it's really, really, really fun. And that game, you know, got bumped up on my list of games to watch. And not just because of the quarterback debacle for your Chicago Bears.
Debacle? They've solved the problem. It's great. There's no debacle at all. The quarterback,
they could have had Cam Newton.
The quarterback resurgence in Chicago. I'm all in on the Nick Foles thing. It took me 1 week to talk myself into it. I'm just setting myself up to get hurt again. But yeah, I'm with you. I'm just excited to see what they look like. I don't think they'll be the best defense in the league by any stretch. Again, playing the Jets and a Vikings team, figuring it out, that tends to help your numbers. And the turnovers are probably definitely going to come back to earth. But I do think that they're well coached, that they finished 19th in defensive DVOA last year. Without DeForest Buckner, without Darius Leonard for a good chunk of the season, with huge question marks at corner, I think that they've done a really good job kind of assembling pieces on that defense. And again, I think Matt Eberflus is very good at his job. So I'll be curious to see what they look like for the rest of the season. All right, Lindsay, typically we each pick someone who we think has the most at stake in a given week. We are not going to do that because there is only one answer this week, and that is Mr. Adam Gase, the head coach of the New York Jets. Where do you want to start with the Adam Gase experience and kind of where we're sitting with it right now?
Well, one, he's only coached 19 games with the Jets.
It's impossible that that's true. I was looking at this before we started recording. I expected him to have a record of like 10-35 as the head coach of the Jets or something. He's only coached 19 games. It feels like he's been there for 20 years because this has been interminable. I cannot believe it's only been a season and a half.
Just because think of all the shit that's gone down with the Jets since that. I mean, Sam Darnold got mono. I mean, the Le'Veon Bell contract.
It's
everything
things.
With Jamal Adams. I mean, there was a lot
of
stuff.
The hyperdrive comment
down.
Last week. Every single, the eyes at the press conference. It has been even if it weren't in New York, I feel like this would have been a jam-packed year and a half of Adam Gase follies. With whatever franchise he had landed with. I cannot believe that we've done this. It's, I probably said it was an okay hire at the time because I didn't think the Jets or the Dolphins' talent was that good. I was very, very wrong about that because everybody who has left Adam Gase's umbrella has been great. Ryan Tannehill, several Jets position players, or several Dolphins skill position players. It is unbelievable how bad this team is right now. Let me read off some stuff for you. The Jets are currently 31st in pass defense DVOA and 31st in offensive DVOA. They are dead last in EPA per play. They're scoring touchdowns on 33% of their red zone drives. That's dead last in the league. The Seahawks are at 100, by the way. And they're only four, I think they're only five teams. There are six teams even below 50%. And the Jets are at 33%. They are the worst possible football team that you could imagine in today's day and age. They do nothing well. So my question to you, if the Jets, I mean, what, is there anything else to say? You're laughing right now. They do nothing well. They are a horrendous team. So I don't like to call for people losing their jobs. When a coach gets fired, a lot of other people get fired. They have staffs, they have families, everything. But sometimes you have to deal with the realities of this stuff. If Adam Gase loses to Brett Rypien tonight, after people will be listening to this, is there any conceivable reason why he should remain the head coach of the New York Jets?
No, I don't think so. And, you know, I think it now feels inevitable. So whether it's October 2nd or November 2nd or January 2nd, I think the outcome is going to be the same. And, you know, you tend to hang on to a coach who you know is probably going to get fired if he's a guy that the players are still responding to, that, you know, the message is getting through. If the roster is good, you see some sort of chance for them, this thing to turn around. But I don't think any of those things are happening with the Jets. I mean, have you heard any stories coming out of that franchise about guys rallying around Adam Gase the way that Falcons players have rallied around Dan Quinn in recent years? No, that hasn't happened. If anything, he's been at the center of a lot of the drama that's gone on, the stuff with Le'Veon Bell, some of the Jamal Adams stuff that before they ended up trading Jamal Adams away. And, you know, the reason that Adam Gase was hired by the Jets was not because of the job that he did as the head coach of the Miami Dolphins. It was because of his reputation for working with quarterbacks. And he built his reputation as a quarterback guru by working with Peyton Manning.
Which is the biggest bunch of bullshit I could possibly imagine.
And Peyton loves him. They hit it off right away. When Peyton took that, or when Peyton came to Denver, they hit it off right away. You know, Peyton is in his corner, has given him endorsements, you know, and I think he is a good coach. And I've known Adam a long time in Denver, and, you know, we personally get along well and all that sort of stuff. But I don't think this is the right situation for him. I don't think being a head coach, I don't know how much he loves it. He never seems like he's like juiced to be a head coach. It just never seemed to be the right fit. And he was hired to develop Sam Darnold. And Sam Darnold has regressed by every measure in the year and a half or so, in the 19 games. And yes, there has been some bad luck mixed in there. There's been some very questionable talent around the rest of the roster, both at receiver and especially on the offensive line. I mean, they made all these efforts to try to improve their offensive line this year, basically by just throwing out all these new bodies. But with the exception of Mekhi Becton, who's been hurt on and off through 3 weeks, they're not any better on the offensive line really than they were a year ago. And Sam Darnold is getting worse. You hired this guy to make Sam Darnold better. There's a lot of drama with him, with everybody else on the team. You're basically become an embarrassment of an NFL franchise. So I don't know why you would prolong what really is going to be the inevitable.
Can you remember a team that sounded as beaten down as they sound? I mean, when you hear Adam Gase in front of the media, he looks like he's the most miserable person in the world. Darnold came out and had his press conference earlier in the week, and it looked like a hostage video. I mean, it is the tone surrounding the most important people in this franchise is unlike anything I can remember. When teams lose, they're clearly not having a good time, and you can see it. But it just feels like this is an entirely different step. And when you're thinking about, I think the Dan Quinn point is a very good one. With the Falcons, what are you really, really missing out on if you keep Dan Quinn through the rest of the season? You're not milking everything you can out of the 2020 season. I'm not sure how much you would be able to with a different coach. With Darnold, every week you continue this is one more week where he's getting lost. Lost and going further down a rabbit hole you do not want to go down. You need to salvage him by any means necessary at this point. And I just think if one more week, every single day he's in this situation is detrimental to his development. I'm not sure if Sam Darnold is salvageable at this point, but you need to do something to try to figure out if he is.
Yeah, I think so. And look, so does this become a situation? Do they fire him? Does Greg Williams become the interim head coach? Is this just a repeat of the Browns?
Greg Williams, I don't think it's an accident that Greg Williams continually becomes the interim coach of all of these terrible teams.
I mean, it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't Adam, you know, Gase wasn't dying to bring Greg Williams on. It was a little like interim coach insurance almost. So, I mean, there's kind of a system in place there. You know, you keep Dowell Loggins as the guy who can keep working with Darnold throughout this year.
Man, their staff is not good, man. It is a bunch of people who have not been successful other places.
Right. So, I mean, I just think this all has to be, and this is just a really rough time because you have to make that decision about Darnold's future. You know, if you're going to pick up his fifth year option, you have to pick that up next offseason. And if this is already shaping up to be a completely lost year, just why prolong it? And yeah,
at this I think you're pumping up his trade value. If they finish with the number one pick, if they have the worst record in the NFL, there is a 0% chance that they keep Sam Darnold, right? Why would you? If Trevor Lawrence is there, you absolutely draft Trevor Lawrence and trade Sam Darnold. The question is, how much can you get for Sam Darnold? Right now, it's pretty much nothing. If you have some semblance of hope by the end of the year, he has some flashes, he starts playing like he doesn't hate everything about his life, maybe you can squeeze something out of that deal. At this point, that seems like the best case scenario for them.
God, poor Trevor Lawrence, man. Let's just...
Well, at least he won to be coached by Adam Gase.
That's true. He can get coached by... Brian Daboll. I don't know. Like, who's going to be
Eric Bieniemy, whoever. Somebody who actually comes from, at least Eric Daboll. Let's combine them into one person. At least Eric Bieniemy and Brian Daboll have had success in the NFL with someone not named Peyton Manning. That's a step in the right direction in terms of building a solid foundation for Trevor Lawrence.
Yeah, the other guy that Adam Gase had success with was Tim Tebow, and it was basically just making him look like a semi-functional quarterback.
He hasn't done that with Sam Darnold, so that's better than he's done in anything since, and he definitely didn't do that with Ryan Tannehill. All right, Lindsay, every week we try to answer the one big question that we have going into the weekend. What is your one big question heading into week four?
All right, well, so, you know, this slate of games isn't fantastic. It's not like last week where I needed like 18 shots of espresso just to get through the morning's games because they were so exciting. But look,
we're breaking down Nick Foles against the Colts defense doesn't let you know that we're not really dealing with a great slate here.
A little bit. Yeah. But we do have Vikings Texans this week, which are two teams that I think a lot of people would have picked to either be in the playoffs. I think a lot of us picked the Vikings to either win the NFC North or be a playoff team in the NFC North. And, you know, the Texans, who have been a consistent playoff team recently, but they're now sitting here at 0-3. There's only one team in NFL history who survived an 0-4 start to make the playoffs. That was that 92 San Diego Chargers team. So one of these teams is going to be in a really bad spot sitting there at 0-4. And my big question right now is with the Texans, are they as bad as 0-3 looks, or are they just really the victims of probably the most difficult schedule start of anybody in the NFL, having to play the Chiefs, the Ravens, and then the Steelers? Those three teams right now, you know, there's only one loss between them, and that is the Ravens losing to the Chiefs. So this is as difficult of a start to a season as any team has had to have in the NFL. They still have one of the, you know, top five quarterbacks. I mean, would we put Deshaun Watson top five, top seven, you know, one of those upper tier quarterbacks. If they lose this game, then I'm putting the alert panic on the Texans and just kind of blowing up their season. But for a game between two 0-3 teams, I'm actually really, really interested to see a lot of what's going to happen. You know, the Vikings obviously played a lot better last week. They almost beat the Titans, a Titans team that we now know was playing without their defensive coordinator, and they had to shift some play calling duties and stuff around. So they seem like they were maybe starting to get it together. We're getting a little closer. And, you know, now the Texans, who have you know, some talent, but maybe just haven't been able to show it because of the other teams that they've been playing.
You will get no sympathy from me about the Houston Texans this season. Every single thing that this franchise has done for the past 6 months has been, even longer than that, probably a year, has been to its own detriment. The way they've valued players, the way they've acquired players, the way they've thought about how they build their roster, the way they thought about how they built this offense. Do you know who is dead last in the NFL in play action percentage?
Deshaun I'm guessing Watson. It's the Houston Texans.
There are very simple ways to help your quarterback build a plan for him against the blitz, having really good hot plans, kind of insulating him with easy throws. The Texans don't throw screens. They don't use play action. They essentially have thrown Deshaun Watson out there and said, good luck, buddy, figure it out. And every once in a while, like he did against in the first half of the Steelers, he's good enough to do that. Asking him to do that is unfair. It's not how you should be doing this, and it's how they've done it with both the way they've played schematically and with the way they've assembled talent on this team. So do I think they're better than 0-3? Yeah, probably. But do I think they deserve to be anything but 0-3? And do I think that they're going to be a relevant team for the rest of the season? No.
I just want to be clear. Every time you're saying they, do you mean Bill O'Brien?
I'm trying to be less mean. I'm just trying to spread out the blame here a little bit. The plan and the execution of that plan have been poor, and I do not expect it to go any other direction. Having one of the best vertical passers in the entire NFL and using play action on 14% of your dropbacks is a crime against the sport.
I just feel bad for Deshaun. You said you don't have a lot of sympathy for the Texans, and it's certainly not for Bill O'Brien. I do for Deshaun Watson. I really do. Like, imagine the last couple of weeks or those first 2 weeks of the season and watching, you know, his two peers, Patrick Mahomes and Lamar Jackson, and in the situation,
or DeAndre Hopkins
there
catching like 10 passes a game.
And yeah, exactly. And going, what is going on? Why did I just resign here? I mean, he's got a ton of cash now, which is great, and a ton of security, but
Sure. I could just imagine him as that Wolverine meme, just laying in bed looking at a picture of DeAndre Hopkins. That's probably what he's doing right now, because it's the only solace he can find. All right. My one big question, it's a pretty simple one. We don't really have to belabor this. Can the Saints get their shit together? Like, is this going to happen at any point? Sean Payton came out this week and said that they defended the bootleg last week like a high school team, which I think is a pretty accurate assessment of the way they played against Green Bay. I thought even if the offense struggled with Drew Brees' arm being in question, with Michael Thomas being out of the lineup, all that stuff, that the defense would be able to carry them. When I pick this team to win the Super Bowl, I picked them because I thought they had the best roster in the NFL. They have not played that way. And we talked about it with Sam Monson on yesterday's show. They look old, but even the players on this team that aren't old haven't played very well. Malcolm Jenkins got picked on against the Raiders, but it's not as if he's been the lone culprit in that secondary. Marshon Lattimore hasn't played well. Marcus Williams hasn't played well. These are all pro type players that just really haven't gotten it together this year. And we've seen them in the past really put it together after rough starts to the season, especially on defense. So coming out against a Lions offense that has some talent and is a pretty good group, but is by no means one of the top five units in the league, can you come clamp down this team and show that you're a team to be reckoned with here moving forward for the rest of the season? I would like to see them put together a complete game.
Yeah, I would too. And look, I mean, Drew Brees' downfield passing game is just not coming back. Like, it's not something he's going to rediscover in October.
But they haven't had that in years past. Over the last 3 years, they haven't had that. And they've been fine because they're so talented. And this year, the talent has not been able to take over.
So they need to adapt. And look, Michael Thomas practiced today.
That's huge.
He was spotted during the open portion of practice. So we'll see. I mean, high ankle sprains are really tricky. Getting him back will be huge. But now they've got some offensive line injuries they're having to deal with. I do have faith in Sean Payton and his mind. But you're absolutely right about, you know, they're not getting enough out of the rest of their talent. And I don't know. A lot of us picked them to make the Super Bowl. And so I think we're hanging on to this idea of they should be good. And this is the end of this window with Brees. And they need to figure out a way to win when they can't maybe rely on him being the same player that he was before.
The thing is, though, they have those offensive line injuries, but I have faith in their ability to overcome them. It's one of the reasons that I thought that they would be able to sustain pretty much anything that happened to them is because they were so deep. So now you can bring in Cesar Ruiz, who you drafted very high in the draft. They have depth in those areas. And they've been missing Marcus Davenport and David Onyemata missed last week. They have players in those spots to kind of make up for that. So even if they've been banged up outside of the Michael Thomas thing, there's no even one, two, or three injuries where it's like, you know what? Let's give them a break here. They were supposed to be able to transcend stuff like that in a way that other less deep teams couldn't, and they still haven't been able to. So now, if you get a little bit healthier, if you get a little bit of a groove, can the best players on your team start playing like it? That's my biggest question here, and I would like to see it sooner rather than later. All right, guys, that's all we got. I am. I'm not sure I'll be watching Jets Broncos. I think I might practice some self care and dig back into the leftovers.
Oh, I'm gonna watch every snap.
Oh, I'm sure you will.
It's going to happen. I'm probably gonna live tweet it because I live in Denver. I mean, I have to. It's what my entire Twitter timeline is gonna be talking about. I have to watch the train wreck. I'm not excited about it, but I'm gonna watch it, and I'll probably have a beer or six.
I don't do things that are good for me, so I will be watching the game as well. I shouldn't if I was just playing, you know, really considering my mental health and trying to do the best things for myself, but I probably will be watching the game. All right, guys, we will be back on Sunday night with me and Nate breaking down the week 4 slate. Until then, please do me a favor, subscribe and rate the podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Really appreciate that. For now, though, we're going to take a break. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the football. We'll talk to you on Sunday.
This was the Athletic Football Show.